such as Sir Walter Scott's Lady of the Lake, 1810, Waverley, 1814, Rob Roy, 1817, and Ivanhoe, 1820, and the comparing of Britannia's invincibility with the legends and deeds of dragon-busting knights inspired many an overture, play, pageant, or opera. Sir Arthur Sullivan, whose comic operettas written with W.S. Gilbert successfully lampooned Victorian pomposity, wrote one serious opera, Ivanhoe, 1891. As suitable subject matter for Wagner, never mind Sullivan, Scott's Legend of Ivanhoe ticked nearly all the boxes, telling as it does the struggle in 1194, in the aftermath of the Third Crusade, of a noble Saxon against nasty Norman Frenchmen. But that it also concerns itself with unfair treatment of England's medieval Jewish population would have ruled it out for the arch-anti-Semite Wagner. When they are not concerned with mythical Teutonic heroism, Wagner's music dramas focus on sacrifice and self-denial, like Tristan und Isolde and Parsifal, or they tackle the inevitability of the corruption of power, or all of the above at once, as is the case in his monumental four-opera cycle, The Ring of the Nibelung. It took Wagner 26 years to create his Ring cycle, completed in 1874. It's far and away the most ambitious undertaking in the history of European music. What's more, he wrote the libretto as well as the music, and drew up the specifications of the purpose-built theatre at Bayreuth in which it was to be performed. His aim was to produce nothing less than a modern equivalent of the drama of the ancient Greeks. Works like Aeschylus's Oresteia trilogy had hoped to distill and dramatise the experiences of a whole society, and this is what Wagner meant to do for his, a recently unified Germany still finding its feet as a modern nation. He sifted through many sources for his material, but in the main he concentrated on a set of ancient Icelandic documents known as the Eddas. He mixed in various plot lines from Austrian, Norwegian and German sagas and set about moulding them into a coherent dramatic whole. The plot initially hinges on the idea that the love of gold leads to corruption and disaster, but it soon becomes embroiled in the legend of Siegfried, an innocent, brave nature man who sacrifices his life for the common good and has an incestuous relationship with his aunt. The story, spread over the four separate operas, begins with the theft of a precious golden ring from the depths of the River Rhine, which represents indomitable, deathless Germany. Along the way, there is internecine strife between the gods and some flying Hell's Angels, the magnificently apocalyptic Valkyries. The Valkyries, with their leader Brunhilde, are the warrior daughters of Wotan, a Zeus-like overlord, and have the second opera of the sequence named after them. Their job is to fly around the world picking up dead warriors to act, when resurrected, as bodyguards for the gods' home of Valhalla. So they are airborne undertakers, in a way. In the final opera of the four, The Twilight of the Gods, Wagner made mayhem with the Icelandic concept of Ragnarok, the destruction of the gods as preordained by fate. Valhalla is razed to the ground in a staggering climax, which includes Brunhilde riding her flying horse into the flames and the Rhine Maiden mermaids leaping out of the overflowing river and reclaiming their stolen golden ring. Wagner's vision was the product of a restless, angry age. All Europe was reeling from the implications of Charles Darwin's two shattering books, On the Origin of Species, 1859, and The Descent of Man, 1871. Darwin himself had come hard on the heels of Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, 1830-33, in which he showed that the world had not begun with a single act of creation, and Ernest Renan's Life of Jesus, 1863, which questioned the Bible as historical truth. God himself, it was now being suggested, had been made in man's image and not the other way round. This idea is now a commonplace, but in the middle of the 19th century its effect was devastating, not dissimilar to the revelation 5 centuries earlier that the earth travelled round the sun and not vice versa. So in a monumental piece of symbolism that defined his age, at the end of The Ring, Wagner annihilated the gods altogether in his musical Armageddon. That said, it's only fair to point out that Wagner's keenest interest was not the fate of the gods, but rather what happened to humanity. Without God, without judgment, without fear of retribution, mankind's biggest bullies could now, in theory, rule supreme. The formidable advance of science and technology in Wagner's time, instead of making people confident and liberated, made them fearful and vulnerable, ripe for exploitation. Throughout Europe, industrial capitalism, coupled with military force on a frightening scale, loomed ominously. It seemed to many, including Karl Marx, who published the first part of Das Kapital in 1867, to promote nothing but widespread poverty, inequality, and hopelessness. The power of much of the Ring's music reflects this dark, foreboding image of industrial might. During the first opera, the Rheingold, were taken down into the depths of a menacing and fiery mine, with dehumanized workers slaving to extract gold. Other artists shared this sense of despondency. The French writer Émile Zola, for example, thought that the industrial age had brought to working people untold misery and cruelty. The vast, devouring machine of technology in Zola's Germinal, set in a grim coal-mining landscape with money-crazed bosses brutally abusing their workers and treating their women as little more than sex slaves, finds considerable resonance in The Ring. Zola himself also embarked upon a project as vast and all-encompassing as Wagner's Ring, a 20-book epic called Les Rouges en Macquart, which follows the fortunes of a family living in mid-19th century France. But the greatest single influence on the Ring cycle, and indeed on two of Wagner's other operas, Tristan und Isolde and Parsifal, was not Karl Marx or Charles Darwin, but rather the German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer's theories, like Wagner's operas, could not be described as succinct, and they are consequently hard to summarise briefly. But the idea that caught Wagner's imagination was that we humans are essentially irrational, emotional animals. As Zola also sought to demonstrate in Les Rouges en Macquart, the trajectory of our lives is predetermined by our genetic inheritance. All efforts to reform or control our desires are therefore pointless. Our sexuality, our cravings, and our longings totally dominate our minds, and since our appetites can never be satisfied, we are always projecting our happiness into the future. We are always preparing to live. In Schopenhauer's worldview, there is no God, no afterlife, no heaven, no redemption, just oblivion. The only way to kill off our insatiable desire is through death. One can interpret the end of the world in The Ring's finale, The Twilight of the Gods, Götterdämmerung, as the destruction of greed and overbearing authority, or as a sort of Buddhist oblivion. Either way, the outcome is nothingness. According to this philosophy, Tristan's and Isolde's forbidden love, she's married to his friend Mark, can only be properly consummated in death. Schopenhauer's deeply pessimistic outlook can also be detected in the novels of Thomas Hardy, for example, Far from the Madding Crowd, which was completed in 1874, the same year as Wagner's Ring. Hardy's characters are buffeted around by their fates, over which they have absolutely no control. In the end, the good and the bad get roughly the same deal from life. Above all, Wagner's focus was on the psychology of his characters. Their actions were merely the symbolic manifestation of their deeper desires. In this respect, he was preempting Sigmund Freud's revolutionary way of looking at the motives and behaviour of men and women. Wagner's characters were archetypes, models for every man. In The Ring, he was much more interested in what his heroes and heroines felt than what they did. As Freud was to do some years later, Wagner tackled taboo and controversy head-on. His operas are unabashed in their treatment of sexuality and eroticism, race, death and incest. All this in the 1860s and 70s. In order to help us perceive a character's feelings or motivations, Wagner needed tools at his fingertips to be able to enrich and layer the music. One such technique is his use of fragments of melody, or rhythm, or harmony, as calling cards of a character, a place, an idea, an object, or a memory. These musical cells, from which he created the whole web of the music, were later called leitmotif. He didn't invent the leitmotif, the credit for which lies squarely with the opera composer and distinguished writer E.T.A. Hoffmann, 60-odd years earlier, and it owes a fair amount to the idée fixe in Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique too. But he did ultimately make it his own, such was the power, breadth and ingenuity with which he deployed it. At its simplest, leitmotif is a straightforward association of a nugget of tune with a character. Every time the character appears or is mentioned or thought of by someone else, we hear that nugget. In The Ring, every character has his or her own leitmotif or signature tune. Other motifs in the story are attached to concepts, for example, transformation or love or servitude, or to things such as a spear, the gold or the River Rhine. There are, in fact, hundreds of leitmotifs in The Ring which can be layered simultaneously on top of each other or introduced in quick succession. By the end of each opera, they are cropping up at an astonishing rate, sometimes several in every bar. They become a vast tapestry on which the music and the story hang. Thus, the orchestra, instead of merely providing the musical backing for the characters to sing to, was able to express or hint at the meaning of the stage action, even in passages without singing. While in Verdi's dramas the orchestra reflected and underpinned the human drama acted out by the singers, in The Ring it was the opposite. What was seen on the stage was a visual representation of the music. Not content with the orchestra as inherited from the concert hall, the demands of The Ring's score included instruments that needed to be especially adapted for the purpose, or even prompted the development of new instruments altogether. For example, though Verdi had used anvils as part of a gypsy chorus in his opera Il Trovatore in 1853, Wagner outdid him in The Rheingold and Siegfried by employing 18 bespoke tuned anvils. That is to say, they were calibrated to sound particular notes as determined by the score. The Ring also called for the invention of subsequently dubbed Wagner tubas, a hybrid that combined elements of the French horn, trombone and euphonium. To stage The Ring, Wagner had his own theatre erected at Bayreuth. Much about its design was revolutionary. Instead of having a distracting orchestra pit in front of the stage, he instructed his designers to hide the musicians underneath it and had their sound waft up into the auditorium. He ordered the modernisation of the stage and lighting effects, had scenery moving silently on and off sideways, had a steam curtain invented, and played optical illusions with perspective to make his giants giant and his dwarfs dwarfed. Wagner's theatre was an early attempt at what we would associate with the cinema rather than the theatre experience. It was a darkened magic lantern show, fantastical and all-embracing. For The Ring's first complete performance, Wagner decreed that the house lights should be dimmed. This was such a novelty at the time, it drew gasps from the audience. Wagner's ambition was nothing less than the creation of the art form of the future, in which all the arts would combine and fuse, led by the unequally greater power of music. The Ring may have aspired, through ancient myth, to explain and explore basic human instincts, yet it was still, by and large, a series of oversized operas. But having destroyed the old gods in its finale, The Twilight of the Gods, Wagner's next move was to found a new religion. In his final piece, Parsifal, of 1882, Wagner turned the theatre into a temple, the plot into a sacramental ritual, and the leitmotifs he bestowed with sacred power. Instead of calling it an opera, or even a music drama, Wagner omnipotently referred to Parsifal as a festival play for the consecration of the stage, insisting that the exclusive rights to perform it should remain in perpetuity at Bayreuth, other theatres and opera houses being thought unworthy of doing justice to such a precious creation. In fact, the exclusion lasted only until 1903, not the end of the world, as he'd hoped. Though this proviso may sound far-fetched, Wagner's admirers had indeed begun to see Bayreuth as a very special place, the holiest of holies, well before he embarked on Parsifal. Audience members saw themselves as communicants, humble supplicants at the high altar, even while Wagner was still very much flesh and blood. It's ironic that, as a young man, Wagner had raged against the arts world as a nauseating bourgeois elitist clique that was closed to the masses, the folk, who needed its balm and illumination most. He frequently extolled the all-encompassing virtues of ancient Greek theatre, which drew its audience from the government and judicial buildings, from the country, from ships, from military barracks, and from the furthest regions. His operas would be for the common people at sensible knock-down prices. His operas would rip to shreds the comfortable and suffocating morality of the middle classes. The reality was that Wagner could only have a theatre built for him and his own pieces put on there thanks to the generosity of the very people he had previously so detested. And there is no opera house in the world more exclusive than Bayreuth. A few years after Wagner's death, Mark Twain gave a striking impression of what the unsuspecting visitor might expect from a visit there. "I have seen all sorts of audiences, at theatres, operas, concerts, lectures, sermons, funerals, but none which was the twin to the Wagner audience of Bayreuth, for fixed and reverential attention, absolute attention and petrified retention to the end of an act of the attitude assumed at the beginning of it. This opera of Tristan und Isolde last night broke the hearts of all witnesses who were of the faith, and I know of some who have heard of many who could not sleep after it, but cried the night away. I feel strongly out of place here. Sometimes I feel like the sane person in a community of the mad. Sometimes I feel like the one blind man where all others see, the one groping savage in the college of the learned, and always, during service, I feel like a heretic in heaven." George Bernard Shaw, on the other hand, was one of the adoring congregation, reporting, "Most of us at present are so helplessly under the spell of the Ring's greatness that we can do nothing but go raving about the theatre between the acts in ecstasies of deluded admiration." For musicians, the Wagner Shrine at Bayreuth became a place of pilgrimage, sure enough, and because of the cutting-edge style of the vast, demanding music dramas mounted there, it also became a rallying point for all that was modern and progressive in music. Wagner followers gloried in the alarm his work often provoked among outsiders. The more difficult the mountain was to climb, the more avant-garde, the better, they believed. Indeed, it's possible to date the chasm that was to develop between the populist mainstream and the classical avant-garde in music to this place and time. The schism was to last over 80 years. Wagner's acolytes were happy to have retreated into their private Valhalla, where only the initiated, the learned, and the bold would venture to tread. The composer Arnold Schoenberg, an admirer of the way in which Wagner seemed to mould audiences to his will, declared in 1946, "Those who compose because they want to please others and have audiences in mind are not real artists." All religions, even musical ones, need their Eucharist, their puja, their shahada, their pirit, moments of high observance and ritual. Wagner provided his cult with the solemn act of devotion, purification and veneration that is Parsifal. Set in medieval Spain, Parsifal is ostensibly a parable about the Holy Grail, the cup from which Christ drank at the Last Supper. It doesn't so much have a plot as a series of ritualistic scenes, and its imagery and context wouldn't be out of place if one stumbled across them at the secret tombs of the Knights Templar in Rennes-le-Château, on Glastonbury Tor, or in the pages of a Dan Brown novel. It's easy to poo-poo its symbols and magic, its Doctor Who-like time travel, and, since Monty Python covered the source material, it's always a struggle to see the Knights of the Holy Grail on stage without sniggering. But there is a deadly serious intent in Parsifal. At its heart lies a theory Wagner drew from Schopenhauer, from Buddhism and from Christianity, that self-enlightenment, or personal redemption, is achieved by denying oneself gratification, resisting temptation, and seeking an understanding of fellow suffering. Compassion, the piece teaches, has a healing and liberating power. There's nothing mad or fanciful about this idea, and the first and third acts of Parsifal, the acts that take place in the Grail's mountain refuge of Monsalvat, contain music of breathtaking grandeur and beauty to match the deeply felt beliefs underpinning it. The so-called transformation music, during which the young Parsifal is taken into the castle to witness the Holy Communion of the Knights Templar, has to be one of the most awe-inspiring, heart-stopping moments in all European orchestral music. Though it's powerful, it's not triumphant, it's agonising. At its climax is a leitmotif associated with suffering. Fellow composer Gustav Mahler described hearing this as the greatest and most soul-wrenching experience of my life. Musically, Parsifal derives much of its seductive power from Wagner's frequent disruption of the listener's expectations. He'd played with expectation and fulfilment liberally in Tristan und Isolde, but in that case, the purpose of his harmonic delaying tactics was to portray sexual desire, arousal and consummation, or lack of it. In Parsifal, his agenda was spiritual rather than physical, and the technique he relied on to intoxicate the listener is called chromaticism. The term chromaticism comes from the Greek word for colour. It is the musical equivalent of filling a painted canvas with thousands of colours instead of just a few. This is how it works. As we've already seen, all the world's musical systems recognise the natural and perfect relationship between a note made by plucking a string and its little brother made by plucking a string half the length, the helpfully named octave. We've also seen that the number of times you subdivide the distance within this octave is up for grabs. In some cultures, there can be as many as 60 subdivisions between the two, or even, theoretically at least, 360 in an ancient Chinese system. But in Western and Indian classical music, the distance has in recent centuries been divided into 12 steps. Western music, being more orientated towards harmony than its non-Western counterparts, gradually formed hierarchies among the 12 notes so that the listener's ears latched on to a home in the sound. It was a little bit like shaping a wild, natural landscape into identifiable patterns for the benefit of the human onlooker. As soon as there was a centre of gravity or a home in the sound, the relationship between chords also started to coalesce into hierarchies. For Mozart or Haydn, the hierarchy of chords was so strict that the listener is never far from the home key centre. As the 19th century progressed, though, the lure of the three governing triads, 1, 4 and 5, began to pall, and the strength of the previously well-defined chords began to blur. The more weight composers gave to the junior notes and lesser chords, the more they allowed the harmony to lose its sense of familiarity, reassurance and comfort. It was a deliberate attempt to make harmony sound unstable and more exotic in flavour. By the time of Liszt and Wagner, the hierarchies were all but gone. In the opening prelude of Parsifal's third act, the music shifts and slides around, avoiding settling on one key or chord for more than one beat. This is extreme chromaticism at work. You're meant to feel disorientated and in the grip of mysterious powers. The harmony is in meltdown because Wagner has used chromaticism, the promiscuous use of all the subdivisions in the scale, to put you in an unsettling place. As it happens, that place is the Temple of the Holy Grail, Montsalvat, and the atmosphere is tense and unresolved. As an intriguing footnote to the rich world of chromaticism, the Russian composer Alexander Scriabin, who was 10 years old when Parsifal opened, took the colour of notes idea to a whole new level in theories he developed from around 1907 onwards. He assigned each of the 12 notes in the scale a different colour based on optics, Sir Isaac Newton's 1704 study of light, colour and diffraction. He also helped his friend, chemist and electrical engineer Alexander Moser invent a light-projecting colour organ, the chromola, also known as the clavier à lumière or tastiera di luce, which could play the coloured lights corresponding to the 12 notes of a keyboard, as directed by Scriabin's score. Part of this contraption, looking, dare I say it, like something that has fallen off a stall at a fair, is preserved in the Scriabin Museum in Moscow. Scriabin's music, as heard in his complex Prometheus Poem of Fire, 1910, is highly idiosyncratic, not to say hallucinogenic, like an intermingled Chopin and Debussy with Parsifal and Stravinsky's The Firebird being played simultaneously in the background. Scriabin was born on Christmas Day and died at Easter, and rather aptly toyed with the idea that he might be the reincarnation of Christ, once writing, "I am God. I am nothing. I am play. I am freedom. I am life. I am the boundary. I am the peak." Wagner wasn't the only one who believed music and mysticism could fuse to become the religion of the future. As for Wagner, he was at pains to point out in his autobiography the symbolism of his having had the idea for an opera of the Parsifal legend on Good Friday. "I suddenly remembered that the day was Good Friday, and I called to mind the significance this omen had already once assumed for me when I was reading Wolfram's Parsifal. Its noble possibilities struck me with overwhelming force, and out of my thoughts about Good Friday I rapidly conceived a whole drama, of which I made a rough sketch with a few dashes of the pen, dividing the whole into three acts." With its heady concoction of chromaticism, rich, sweeping orchestral landscapes, ethereal musical representations of heavenly bliss, its highly developed leitmotifs, and its fervent invocation of compassion and enlightenment, Parsifal is undoubtedly the work of a mountainous talent sincerely seeking to give meaning to life and the world around him. A fairly typical summary of the thousands of pages of reverential prose that it prompted when first performed is that of Charles Albert Ligge, whose 1899 book on Wagner concluded, "As the ring is the embodiment of human love, so is Parsifal the expression of the love divine. Parsifal, in truth, is not a drama, it is a religious ceremony. It is one of those works from which the cold lance of criticism glances without piercing. It is more seemly to regard it as the last message to his fellow creatures of a man who laboured with all his strength to propagate the noble truth, love is of God. As such, let us honour both it and its author." There is, however, another side to the philosophy driving Parsifal, and it's a side that for some Wagner worshippers flipped a switch. It's not possible to sidestep the fact that the climax of this Crusader story homes in on the magical properties of the spear that allegedly pierced the side of the crucified Jesus of Nazareth, only ever referred to as the Redeemer in the text. The pure blood of Christ, the Holy Grail containing it, and the sacrificial significance of Good Friday are all presented as both real and miraculous. The holy blood itself is seen as purifying, purging the evil, the weak, and the sinful. Plotting against the innocent Christian Parsifal is the Darth Vader of the tale, a malicious sorcerer called Klingsor, whose magic garden lies in the Arabic south of Spain, and who, until the 1950s, was typically portrayed in Parsifal productions as of Arabic or Jewish origin. Klingsor, who has castrated himself, is accompanied by a possessed shapeshifter, Kundry, a reincarnation of the cursed Jewish princess Herodias. Klingsor forces Kundry to seduce Parsifal in the hope of contaminating his purity. She enlists the help of her teenage daughters, the Flower Maidens, in her task of sexual entrapment. The much-abused Kundry, having converted to Christianity at the last moment and been duly released from the curse that has trapped her in time, is then killed off at the moment the pure Parsifal becomes chief protector of the Grail, blessed by a dove from heaven. Her final humiliation and the triumph of the Aryan hero Parsifal were not very subtly concealed metaphors for what Wagner wanted to happen to German culture. 2 years earlier, he had boldly compared the superiority of the revelation through Jesus Christ to that through Abraham and Moses. He may have died 7 months after the opening of Parsifal, but tragically, the toxic legacy of his views on Aryan supremacy did not. Although Wagner regarded all foreign influences as potentially threatening to German purity, he singled out the Jews for particular venom. Unfortunately, In 19th century Europe, anti-Semitism was rampant, but Wagner's views were excessive even by the standards of the time. His fanaticism partly stemmed from his own experiences of being a struggling opera composer in his earlier career in Paris, where he developed a personal loathing for the most successful of the grand opera composers of the moment, Giacomo Meyerbeer. It was also stoked by his reading The Inequality of Human Races by Frenchman J. Arthur Gobineau in the 1850s, in which Gobineau declared the superiority of the white European and coined the idea of degenerate or inferior, impure races. Gradually, Wagner adopted a virulently anti-Semitic attitude that polluted his views on almost everything. His avowed agenda was to give the Germans a sense of their historical destiny through the arts. To fulfil this destiny as he conceived it, he believed that it would be necessary to remove all Jews and all trace of Jewish culture from the German Reich. He was not alone in wishing this outcome. 3 years after Parsifal opened, in 1885, German Chancellor Bismarck legislated to expel all Jews and Poles from the Prussian Reich. Within 40 years, this ultra-German nationalism evolved into the cancerous ideology of Nazism. It's no good pretending Wagner wasn't accessory to this slide into xenophobic vitriol. In one of his many inflammatory publications, Erkenne dich selbst, Know Thyself, of 1881, he urged the German folk to awaken and bring about a great solution to the Jews' now so dreaded power among and over us, their eradication. On another occasion, he joked that all Jews should be herded into a theatre for a performance of Gotthard Ephraim Lessing's 1779 play Nathan the Wise, set during the Third Crusade and calling for religious tolerance, and immolated. Wagner could not, of course, have predicted that the Nazis would take him at his word, nor that Hitler would one day proclaim, "Whoever wants to understand National Socialist Germany must know Wagner," or, "I intend to base my religion on the Parsifal legend." But there is no doubt that the Nazi top brass treated Bayreuth as a shrine. They were welcomed with open arms by Wagner's surviving family members. There was even a suggestion that Hitler, known as Uncle Wolf by the Wagner children, might have proposed marriage to Winifred Wagner, the composer's English daughter-in-law. Bayreuth, in fact, had become Montsalvat itself, the mountain-top resting place of the Holy Grail, the high temple of Aryan culture. Joseph Goebbels, head of the Nazi propaganda ministry, idolised Parsifal, which was put on 23 times at Berlin's Deutsche Oper alone during the period of the Third Reich. The 1938 production witnessed the debut of young soprano Elisabeth Schwarzkopf as a flower maiden. Schwarzkopf, darling of the Reich's culture department, later allegedly took the SS general and Nazi governor of Lower Austria, Dr. Hugo Jury, as her lover. He committed suicide on the day of the German surrender. Her career never looked back. New productions of Parsifal were mounted at Bayreuth in 1934 and 1937, though revivals of it were suspended during the war so as to spare the war wounded the insensitivity of scenes involving the wounded knight Amfortas. Propaganda images in Nazi Germany variously depicted the Führer as a Montsalvat knight, or indeed as Parsifal himself, with the dove of benediction hovering above him. Fully understanding the racial implications of Parsifal's message and its preeminence in Nazi ideology, it is uncomfortable for us to hear Wagner's sublime music without wincing. In one way, this became the most dangerous music ever written, because, despite being motivated by a devotion to self-denial and compassion, it undoubtedly inspired hatred. Wagner's influence on the other non-musical arts was considerable. During his lifetime alone, over 10,000 books and articles were written about him. The painter Renoir asked if he could paint a portrait of him and crossed Europe to do so. Picasso made a drawing in response to Parsifal in 1934, a precursor to his world-famous Guernica. D.H. Lawrence wrote a novel, The Trespasser, which was inspired by Wagner's version of Siegfried. Poets, philosophers, and playwrights gushed and paid homage to him, including T.S. Eliot, James Joyce and Oscar Wilde, whose sinister Dorian Gray was an early Wagnerite. Despite all this, his immediate effect on other composers was patchy. Though they were blown away by what he was attempting, very few followed his example into through-composed music drama, except the one-hit-wonder German composer of the opera Hansel and Gretel, Engelbert Humperdinck. French composer Jules Massenet wrote a Parsifal-inspired medieval epic for the opening of the Great Paris Exposition of 1889 called Esclamonde, complete with sorceress, magic sword, masked knight, dastardly Saracens, teletransportation, and a bishop and attendant group of monks performing an exorcism. But despite its scale and mystic pretensions, Esclamonde is musically only fleetingly Wagnerian in its biggest orchestral moments, following instead in the French grand opera tradition of Massenet's 25 other operas, with gigantic triumphant choruses, pipe organ, and a lead soprano required to sing an almost impossible series of high coloratura virtuoso solos. The latter, never mind everything else about Massenet, would have been anathema to drama-obsessed Wagner. Meanwhile, Czech composer Zdeněk Fibich trotted out three pseudo-Wagnerian operas in the 1890s, Hedy, Sarka and Padarkuna, much to the irritation of his anti-German Czech compatriots, and an Englishman, Rutland Boughton, set up what he hoped would be a British Bayreuth at Glastonbury, complete with grand, though low-budget, Arthurian music dramas, a festival that ran from 1914 to 1926. Even Boughton, though, whose fairy opera The Immortal Hour opened at Glastonbury 22 days after the British Empire declared war on Germany in August 1914, didn't emulate Wagner's musical style. He found stimulus in Anglo-Celtic folk music instead. The Glastonbury Festival's future wasn't exactly Bavarian chic and hushed reverence either. It's not so far-fetched to suggest that without his link to the Nazis, most people who were not hardcore opera lovers would by now have lost interest in Wagner. That may sound harsh, but the evidence of Wagner's musical impact is nothing like as convincing as his disciples would have us believe. Everywhere you look in the 1880s, outside Bayreuth, you see composers carrying on as if nothing had happened. Even relatively nearby, in Vienna, Brahms ploughed his symphonic furrow, stylistically unaffected by the Bayreuth hurricanes. Brahms, admittedly a complex personality himself, whose music resolutely resisted the modernising currents that hovered around him in his later years, never quite came to terms with the open hostility Wagner always showed him and his music. The problem was that Wagner felt that writing symphonies was no longer a worthwhile pursuit. In his mind, all art had been subsumed into his new form of music drama. He once wrote scornfully in an article, On Poetry and Composition, of Brahms's attempts to add to Beethoven's hallowed nine symphonies. I know of some famous composers who in their concert masquerades don the disguise of a street singer one day, the Alleluia periwig of Handel the next, the dress of a Jewish Sardas fiddler another time, and then again the guise of a highly respectable symphony dressed up as Number 10. Brahms completed his majestic, abundantly tuneful, highly respectable Third Symphony a few months after Wagner's death. Its first performance by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra in December 1883 was disrupted by Wagnerite hecklers, but it was nevertheless well received by everyone else. On Brahms's death, 4 years later, the English composer Charles Hubert Parry wrote an elegy for Brahms, one of the loveliest tributes ever paid by one composer to another, and a stylistic homage that acknowledges the deep and lasting impact the Poco Allegretto, third movement, of Brahms's Third Symphony had made. In Britain, Parry's Brahmsian lead was followed with conspicuous success by Edward Elgar. Listening to his Enigma Variations of 1899 or his First Symphony of 1908, which Elgar openly admitted was modelled on Brahms's Third Symphony, it is as if the whole Wagner experiment had happened in a vacuum. While Brahms held his nerve against the Wagnerian tide, however, His fellow symphonist Anton Bruckner did not, his numbingly long 9 symphonies reflecting in various degrees his adoration of the man he unselfconsciously called the master. Bruckner's 3rd symphony of 1873 was dedicated to Wagner, and in its first version contained melodic quotations from his idol's operas. His 7th symphony received its premiere at a Wagner memorial concert in December 1884, its second movement, Adagio, being in the form of a funeral lament for Wagner. One has to wonder whether Bruckner's obsession with Wagner's music dramas was in part motivated by a voyeuristic attachment to the sexual content in them, particularly The Ring Cycle and Parsifal. As a lifelong bachelor with an erotic appetite focused exclusively on young girls, whom he continued to stalk, observe and proposition even into his 70s, the mental image of the seductive flower maidens in Parsifal must have enhanced his guilty pleasure in the music no end. Bruckner aside, most of Wagner's contemporaries, while quick to assert his musical brilliance, were as at sea with the whole Wagner and the Future of All Art project as they were with the cultural agendas of his dramas. Tchaikovsky described Parsifal as inconceivable nonsense, Wagner's services to opera of a negative kind, and, commenting on the overall impact of his works, "As regards the dramatic interest of his operas, I find them very poor, often childishly naive." Debussy had this to say on his legacy: "All that remains will be beautiful ruins in whose shadows our grandchildren will dream of the former greatness of this man who was under-endowed only in humanity to be truly great." After Wagner's death, Verdi, now in his 70s, produced 2 final operatic triumphs, both based on Shakespeare plays, Otello, 1887, and his only comedy, Falstaff, in 1893. As with Elgar, it is as if Wagner had never existed. Perhaps it is even more remarkable in Verdi's case, since his was the field of musical theatre, so transformed, or so it was claimed, by the Bayreuth Revolution. The 2 composers, both born in 1813, had pursued parallel but quite separate careers in opera. Wagner's attitude to his Italian rival can be ascertained by his writing a 400-page survey of the state of their chosen art, opera and drama, in 1851, without once mentioning the most famous living composer in the form at the time. For his part, Verdi spoke nothing but praise about his acid-tongued contemporary, writing that Tristan und Isolde was one of the finest creations that has ever issued from a human mind. Wagner apart, there was certainly no evidence that Verdi's style had become unfashionable or was deemed old-fashioned by opera lovers in the 16-year gap between Aida, 1871, and Otello, nor in the 6 further years after the unveiling of Falstaff. Falstaff's premiere at Milan's La Scala in February 1893 was particularly successful and was followed within months by equally rapturous openings in Vienna, conducted by Gustav Mahler, Paris, Hamburg, London and New York. Its sparkling score has a light-hearted family resemblance to the Italian-style operas of Mozart, fond nods and winks to his own colourful back catalogue, and even, I venture, a trace of Gilbert and Sullivan's The Yeoman of the Guard of 5 years earlier, doubtless in tongue-in-cheek recognition of the opera's subject matter. But what there is not is an echo of anything remotely Wagnerian. Old Giuseppe was doubtless heeding the advice of his lead character, Sir John Falstaff. "Va, vecchio John, va, va per la tua via. Go, old Jack, go your own way." It was understandable that Wagner might want to speculate about the art world of the future, one that would encompass within it all the arts, centred on human dramas of love, death and destiny. But it wasn't to be his vision that fulfilled the promise. Motion pictures were to be the artwork of the future, a technological breakthrough that stuttered into life just after his death. The first ever moving picture, Louis Le Prince's Roundhay Garden Scene, dating from 1888. No, Wagner's main contribution to the music that followed him was that all the key composers of the next 30 years, particularly in France, Russia and the New World, were inspired not to emulate him, but to contradict, repudiate and sidestep him. These negative responses to his legacy were to blow music apart, an age of revolution, as radical and savage as anything he might have imagined, was just around the corner. Chapter 6, The Age of Rebellion, 1890-1918. In the 31 years between the death of Richard Wagner in 1883 and the outbreak of the First World War, music was shaken by a series of gigantic convulsions, fundamentally reshaping its sound, its function, and its attitude. Much of the impetus for these changes came from places and people whose voices had not yet been heard on the world stage. For all their preeminence in the 18th and 19th centuries, composers from Austria and Germany would soon be competing for attention with a kaleidoscope of musical stars from elsewhere, notably Russia, France, and the USA. Aside from developments in music, the spotlight of history would shift dramatically towards Russia as the new century dawned, and to the growing industrial might and territorial expansion of the USA, which in the same period added over a dozen new states to its size. Though the period saw the high watermark of the oversized, increasingly ungovernable European colonial empires, British, Austro-Hungarian, Russian, and, to a lesser extent, German, French, Portuguese, Spanish, and Dutch, and for many white citizens of these empires, life had never been more luxurious, pleasurable, or decadent, fertile conditions for the blossoming of musical activity, cracks were beginning to show. The Pax Britannica, for example, was maintained by the fighting of multiple colonial campaigns in South Africa, Bechuanaland, Botswana, Nigeria, Sudan, Zanzibar, Ashanti, Ghana, Afghanistan, the Indian Northwest Frontier, Burma, Tibet, China, and Venezuela. And all European cities were liable to terrorist outrages perpetrated by anarchists and separatists, whose catalogue of assassinations would eventually trigger the First World War. The rebellions that were to shake music, however, were almost entirely divorced from political realities. Even the October Revolution in Russia in 1905, an event with thunderously far-reaching implications for society at large, had minimal impact on the contemporaneous upheavals in music. Music's battles were about direction of travel. Where could Western music go once, as it seemed at the end of the 19th century, all possibilities of the existing system of 12 notes and key families had reached saturation point? Though composers were divided on whether to follow the total art form experiment of Richard Wagner, or the extreme chromaticism of parts of Parsifal, or his building of large musical structures by the manipulation of small cell motifs, all were agreed that his Bayreuth revolution was a watershed that had to be responded to one way or another. Russian composers like Tchaikovsky mostly treated the brouhaha surrounding Wagner's music dramas with disdain. César Cui wrote to fellow composer Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, "Wagner is a man devoid of all talent. His melodies, where they are found at all, are in worse taste than Verdi. All this is covered up with a thick layer of rot. His orchestra is decorative but coarse. The violins squeal throughout on the highest notes and throw the listener into a state of extreme nervousness. I left without waiting for the concert to end, and I assure you that had I stayed longer, both I and my wife would have had a fit of hysterics." Stravinsky's view, having seen Parsifal, was equally scathing. "What I find revolting in the whole affair is the underlying conception which dictated it, the principle of putting a work of art on the same level as the sacred and symbolic ritual which institutes a religious service. And indeed, is not all this comedy of Bayreuth, with its ridiculous formalities, simply an unconscious aping of a religious rite?" The most extreme response to Wagner's music, though, came from France, where it became for many musicians a matter of patriotic duty to spurn the musical fruits of the country that had humiliated them in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71, and where an entirely alternative musical approach was developing. The Société Nationale de Musique, a club with the motto Ars Gallica, was symbolically launched during the German bombardment of Paris, with the express aim of promoting a French style that would carve out a non-German identity. Even without the provocation of his German flag-waving, most French composers took a dim view of Wagner, and in any case, They had their own pace-setters to follow, Camille Saint-Saëns and César Franck, two of the co-founders of the Société Nationale de Musique, and between them, mentors to virtually all the post-Wagner generation of French composers. Despite attempting opera, not very successfully, and composing a symphony that reasserted the possibilities of the form in France, where it had become neglected in favour of grand opera, Belgian-born Franck's main contribution to French music was in the field of chamber music. Here, the delicacy and economy of his style, in sharp contrast to the grandiose scale of so much of the music of the second half of the 19th century, was to be an inspiration to his pupils and protégés. If the French revered any German composer, it wasn't Wagner, but Bach. When they began to tire of the excesses and sentimentality of their own 19th century grand operas, never mind everyone else's, they went back to Bach for inspiration. They loved his clarity, his neatness, and his formal discipline. When the crowd-pulling Charles-Marie Widor played his new organ symphony No. 5, from which the celebrated Toccata comes, at the Palais du Trocadéro as part of the Great Parisian World Fair of 1889, the only other composer on the programme was Bach. Like Widor, Franck and Saint-Saëns were both expert organists, and learning the organ, then as now, meant learning Bach inside out. Saint-Saëns' music is particularly Bachian, parts of his Piano Concerto No. 2, 1868, being at times close to pastiche. Saint-Saëns' most distinguished student was Gabriel Fauré, who, as well as being exposed by his mentor to what was then considered the modern work of Schumann and Liszt, had a thorough grounding in plainchant and sacred choral music. The simple but meandering melodic lines of plainsong were to exert a considerable influence on his composing style as he matured. Above all, Fauré had the confidence to turn his antipathy towards the many-layered complexity of Wagner's music dramas into a much purer, emotionally restrained sound. Even his student compositions, such as the ravishing Cantique de Jean Racine, 1865, for choir and organ, served notice of an unequivocal change of direction, away from lush excess, paving the way for the effortlessly tranquil beauty of his Requiem, completed 23 years later. Listening to Fauré after Brahms, Liszt, Wagner or Tchaikovsky is comparable to someone spring-cleaning and redecorating a teenage boy's bedroom. Gone are the posters of death, psychological torment, superheroes and tragedy. The augmented piles of clothes have been put away, and the windows have been opened to dispel the diminished air. Fauré's exquisite, modest music, from his lilting Pavane for small orchestra, 1887, to the song cycle La Bonne Chanson, 1894, composed to express his secret love for Emma Bardach, they were both married at the time, sounds as if it might have been written on a different planet from the one that housed Wagner's Bayreuth, which was, of course, the idea. An even more radical rejection of complexity can be heard in the piano miniatures of Erik Satie, Fauré's eccentric, half-English contemporary. His first Gymnopédie of 1888, as well as sounding like a long, hot afternoon in the midi after a liquid lunch, can be seen as a deliberate attempt to debunk pomposity and declutter music. Described, rather unfairly, by his tutors at the Paris Conservatoire as the laziest student ever, Satie was a free-thinking intellectual whose obsessions ranged from ancient Greece to the novels of Gustave Flaubert, and who preferred to spend his time with painters and poets in Montmartre than among other musicians. His intense fascination with the straight lines of Gothic architecture may also have contributed to the ultra-simple structures of his Gymnopédie and Nocturne of the following year. No one tried harder than Satie to puncture the pretension of Bayreuth, even if his rejection of the Wagner legacy may have been at times rather puerile. In 1891, he announced the premiere of his new opera, Tristan's Bastard, poking fun at Wagner. It was a hoax. 2 years later, he founded his own church, Église Métropolitaine d'Art de Jésus Conducteur, the Metropolitan Church of Art of Christ the Leader, appointing himself as its only priest. He was also its only member. But Wagner wasn't the only composer who was guilty of creating unnecessary clutter in the eyes of an iconoclast like Satie. French composers of the melodramatic grand opera school, Jules Massenet and Charles Gounod, for example, were just as much a target for his often facetious pen. In 1916, Satie concocted a badly insulting parody of themes from Gounod's opera Mireille, and several of his cabaret songs make fun of Massenet's supposed sentimentality. All in all, French composers' attitudes to the vainglorious ritual of the Wagnerian spectacle, whether it was frivolous like Satie's or philosophical like Faure's, led to a new spirit in their music, soon to be dominated by the sensuous modernity of Claude Debussy and Maurice Ravel. Francis Poulenc neatly summed up the prevailing French ambivalence towards Wagner by saying that, after listening to him, it was necessary to cleanse one's spirit and ears by listening to Mozart. Wagner might have expected the French, whose opera he despised, to rebel against his stylistic leadership. He would have been far more disturbed by the betrayal of German cultural supremacy embarked upon by the most distinguished director of music of the Vienna State Opera in its history, Gustav Mahler. Mahler was born into a bohemian corner of the Austrian Empire, into a German-speaking Jewish community of about 1,000 souls, whose existence was entirely wiped from the map during the Holocaust. It's a painful irony that, as Europe's leading opera conductor in the late 19th century, this most Jewish of composers should have been such a fervent champion of the works of music's most notorious anti-Semite, Richard Wagner. Indeed, his own music, to some extent, takes over from where Wagner's Parsifal left off, although, like Liszt, Mahler had a thoroughly cosmopolitan, non-nationalistic outlook and career. As a bohemian subject of the Austrian Empire, as a poor boy in a profession full of the privileged, as a Jew working in an overwhelmingly Catholic culture, it's not surprising that Mahler should have sought comfort by identifying with the folklore and sounds of his childhood, flavours he liberally sprinkled throughout his 10 completed symphonies. These include strolling klezmer, Jewish folk band musicians, passing military bands and lusty children's choruses. Though he was inevitably drawn to the musical metropolis of Vienna, and there is more than a little of the gemütlich charm of the Viennese in Mahler's music, occasional whiffs of marzipan cake and the swish of the waltz alongside rustic mountain dances, what Mahler did was absorb influences from just about the whole continent. He was a sort of musical embodiment of Ellis Island, with all Europe's exhausted, oppressed cultures finding refuge and a new start in his symphonic embrace. Mahler's symphonies were a new start, all right. He is music's gateway to the 20th century. But it's not just his pan-European style that makes Mahler such a paradigm for 20th century composers. He's also notable for the directness of his musical expression. This is encountered most conspicuously in a set of orchestral songs he composed between 1901 and 1904, the Kindertotenlieder, Songs on the Death of Children. Even in the most heartfelt of previous composers' works, the Funeral March of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, for example, of the songs and piano pieces Robert Schumann wrote for love of his wife Clara, euphemism and generic description allowed there to be a degree of detachment between the creator and listener. Thus, Chopin would entitle a piano work Mazurka or Nocturne, which might have had some deep personal emotional relevance to him as a composer, connected with a memory, a person, an atmosphere, a place in his life, but which can only be guessed at by the listener. Even the most intimate songs of Schubert, Schumann and Mendelssohn soften raw emotion with the poetic image, rejection being portrayed as an iced-up lake or happiness as a bird singing. In the lovely, deservedly famous Schumann song Ich grolle nicht, I bear no grudge, of 1840, for example, the details of the broken love affair it refers to are oblique. There is mention of diamonds unable to illuminate the lover's dark heart and a poisonous snake with an addictive sting, and the protagonist says he will not complain even if the rupture is final. Added to the language of metaphor present in so many musical settings of art songs like Ich grolle nicht was a tendency, often admittedly at the request of censors, to remove the issues and conflicts tackled in operas to a previous era or location, or to retreat into the shady world of myths and fables, gods and goddesses. In his Ring Cycle, Wagner tackles the subjects of incest, or the abuse of power, or greed, all pertinent to 19th century Europe, but transports the action to the distant mists of prehistory. It's as if his operas carry the familiar film disclaimer, any resemblance to real persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental. Mahler, on the other hand, abandoned the smokescreen of euphemism and tried to address difficult issues head-on. He didn't flinch from addressing, musically, his darkest fears. The five poems by the German poet Friedrich Rückert that Mahler compiled into the Kinder Totenlieder cycle confront any parent's most unspeakable nightmares. Rückert had written over 400 poems in the wake of the death of his own children from scarlet fever. His appalling loss bleeds off every line of the poems, and Mahler's music accordingly ranges from utterly bleak numbness, as in Nun will die Sonne so hell aufgehen, now the sun wants to rise as brightly as if nothing terrible had happened during the night, to unbearable sadness, as in Nun sehe ich wohl, warum so dunkel flammen, in which the dying child challenges the parent to look into her eyes, to frantic distress, as in the frighteningly turbulent In diesem Wetter. In this weather, in this windy storm, I would never have sent the children out. They've been carried off. I wasn't able to warn them. In 1907, 4 years after his setting of the poems, Mahler's own five-year-old daughter, Anna Maria, died of scarlet fever, and he confessed to his friend Guido Adler that having lost his daughter, he could not then have written Kinder Totenlieder, the pain being too great to bear. Mahler himself was diagnosed with a terminal heart condition the year of Anna Maria's death. When he too died in 1911, aged 50, he was laid to rest in her grave. His younger daughter, Anna Justine, survived the illness, became a sculptor and fled Nazi Austria for Hampstead, London, where she died in June 1988. The Kinder Totenlieder cycle and movements of Mahler's symphonies of similarly extreme vulnerability were to inspire virtually all the giants of 20th century classical music, long before he was introduced to millions through recordings, in large part by Leonard Bernstein, his unstinting champion in the 1960s. One of so many examples is Shostakovich's 13th Symphony, Babi Yar, the subject of which is the Nazi massacre in a Kiev ravine of 33,771 Jews over the course of 48 hours in September 1941, which is stylistically unthinkable without the pervasive influence of Mahler. Other composers whose work is indebted to his include Igor Stravinsky, Arnold Schoenberg, Alban Berg, Sergei Prokofiev, Jan Sibelius, Leos Janacek, Karol Szymanowski, Béla Bartók, Paul Hindemith, Kurt Weill, Aaron Copland, Benjamin Britten, Leonard Bernstein, and, in film music, Franz Waxman, Erich Korngold, Alfred Newman, Bernard Herrmann, Miklos Roscher, James Horner, Danny Elfman, James Newton Howard, Howard Shaw, John Corigliano,